This is Nikki Glaser from the Nikki Glaser Podcast. On a more serious note, I'm still thinking about that commercial with Tom Brady and Snoop Dogg hating on each other. Because when you listen to the reasons for hating someone or something, you realize just how stupid they really are. There is too much hate in this country, and it's gotta stop. So join us at iHeart in standing up to it. If you see hate, speak up. Call it out. And you can learn more by following at What's Up With Hate.
This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor. I welcome John Yoo from Civitas Institute at the University of Texas, as well an esteemed professor of law, but writing most recently about an event that is deeply buried in my memory, October 20th, 1973, known forever after as the Saturday Night Massacre. President Richard M. Nixon, comfortably reelected by millions of votes the year before, ordered the firing of a special prosecutor named Archibald Cox, who was investigating the allegations that we now know as Watergate. The firing was to be done by Elliot Richardson, the attorney general, who resigned rather than follow the order of the president. Then the duty passed to the deputy attorney general, William Ruckelshaus, who also resigned, falling eventually to a man named Bork, you've heard of him, who did follow through on the president's order and fire Archibald Cox. That became a crisis in government. And the end of that was Richard Nixon's resignation from the presidency the following year. The Saturday Night Massacre took place in a time of great anxiety for the world. There was a confrontation in the Middle East, the 73 war, and there was the fear of the Soviets interfering with combat troops, in which case there was a consideration, we know now, we didn't know then, of having to go to nuclear conflict. There was also a Mr. Agnew, and whether he did or did not take inducements while he was governor of Maryland. All of that anxiety was floating around in addition to the pursuit of Richard Nixon's, what did he know and when did he know it, about the Watergate break-in and the attempt to, you'd have to say in some fashion, spy on the Democratic National Committee. I mention all that because it's background for an article that John has published at the Civitas Institute about shedding ourselves of the weight of the Saturday Night Massacre, of Watergate, and of the constraining of the presidency. John, a very good evening to you. Beg pardon the long introduction, but we do have some people who weren't there at that moment, as we are. We were. What is it that it can describe a presidency hobbled by the memory of Saturday Night Massacre? What does it tell us about the people who use that as an example? Good evening to you.
John, great to be back with you. I have to confess up front, I was barely there. I still barely remember Watergate as a child, and I didn't understand why was everybody getting rid of this guy Nixon? He looked pretty good to me at the time, but I was under the age of 10. And so great to be with you from this new home of mine at Civitas Institute, an academic startup at the University of Texas at Austin. I like to think of it. This whole thing has been brought up because of President Trump's order to drop the charges against your mayor, Eric Adams, under the claim that he had taken bribes in exchange for official favors. The U.S. government has said that it's worth dropping the charges in order to get Mayor Adams's cooperation with the federal government's immigration priorities. Critics are the ones who are raising this is just like the Saturday Night Massacre, because rather than carry out this order, the U.S. attorney, the top federal prosecutor in New York, resigned. Her deputy resigned, and then several lawyers in what we call main justice in Washington, D.C. resigned. And so you can see the echoes of Watergate, where, as you said, President Nixon ordered the attorney general to fire the special counsel. He refused. The deputy attorney general refused. And we now know that Judge Bork, who we all remember from his nomination to the Supreme Court, he also wanted to refuse and resign, but he stayed and fired Archibald Cox for the good of the Justice Department, that there had to be someone left in charge of the department and fire him. But the reason I wrote the article is because the Adams comparison to the Saturday Night Massacre prompted me to think, what is the broader picture of what President Trump is doing, all these executive orders, the effort to place independent agencies under the control of the White House, right? The effort to have efficiency throughout the government, the effort this DOGE committee to examine the books, claims that you can hold off and freeze spending that's wasteful. When I looked at the broader picture, I'm not even sure if Donald Trump thinks or his aides think of it for, at this level, but I think what they're doing is trying to end, to free the presidency of these post-Watergate fetters that were imposed by Congress. After Watergate, after you said, John, President Nixon had to resign, a very huge Democratic majority in Congress in the rest of the 70s passed these laws to try to tie down the presidency, to take away his ability to free spending, for example, to create all these independent inspector generals throughout every agency, whom Trump all just fired a few about 2 weeks ago, efforts to constrain foreign policy, efforts to limit emergency powers, efforts to oversee covert actions. You could go on and on. And we have been living under this post-Watergate system for 50 years now. And I think what Trump is doing, and we're just looking at all these many controversies are all part of this bigger, I think, broader approach, which is to restore the presidency to what it was before Watergate, which I think was a presidency of energy, a presidency of independence, of speed, and that there would be a greater balance between the presidency and Congress and the courts, rather than Congress trying to tie down the very characteristics of the presidency that justified the creation of it in Alexander Hamilton's mind and the vesting of the executive power in a single person.
What happened in the midterm election of 74, and I believe a former president was elected that first year as a senator from Delaware, Mr. Biden. What happened is that Congress had been Democratic throughout Mr. Nixon's first term and was again in the second term, but became overwhelmingly Democratic, so that it was possible for Congress to move through legislation that I see now in looking at your list, John, was deliberately meant to constrain the presidency, no matter whether it was Richard Nixon or his successor, Mr. Ford, or Mr. Carter. The long list here, the two that I feature are the War Powers Resolution of 1973 and the Inspector General's Act of 1978. These effectively, well, I don't want to use a metaphor. I'll just say that they were all new to Congress's relationship with the presidency, which in retrospect looks like it wasn't being treated as a separate branch of government, but as someone to be disciplined. Do I read that correctly, John?
Yes, I think what you saw was an effort to move our system to something like a prime ministerial system where the legislature was in charge and the president is just the agent of the legislature, which is the system our European friends have, where they don't have a separate election for a president. The executive is chosen by Congress virtually. This was, by the way, a plan that was proposed at the Constitutional Convention and rejected, clearly rejected, because it was thought that that actually led to greater tyranny. If you have the executive and legislative power combined, our founders thought, the liberties of the people would possibly be infringed. Better to have two branches fighting with each other. So you could say, John, what was happening after the 73 and the 74 elections was that Congress War Powers Resolution said that presidents could only use force abroad for 30 days and then had to get Congress's permission. There's other statutes like that. The Inspector General Act, then what Congress did later was to put almost like a spy for Congress in each agency to report back to Congress on anything that those agencies were doing, and presidents couldn't fire them. And so you had this effort, I think, John, you're going to describe right, is you have this effort to place the presidency basically under the control of Congress. And this Democratic, huge Democratic majority used this as, used Watergate as the opportunity to seize all of these constitutional powers that the president used to have.
And that is not the way the Constitution is written. So I've often puzzled about how it is you restore balance, because there have been moments in American history where the reverse is true, where it's a dominating chief executive and a compliant or disorganized Congress. At the present, we'll come to this decision about Mr. Adams, but I have to say, as someone who's followed that story very carefully, Eric Adams may or may not have done the wrong thing. I can't tell. It's, you know, there was no evidence in court. But the investigation had been going on for some time, confiscating, or the FBI showing up at the address of his fundraisers, or taking his cell phone and making copies of it, and not being able to get through because he couldn't remember the passcode. All these episodes are very much Tammany Hall romance. That's what it reminds me of. That if you're a mayor in New York or a politician in New York, you deal with the legacy of the fact that you are creative when it comes to the law. That doesn't rise anywhere close to the concerns of Watergate, which was about the president himself covering up what was regarded as crimes, a series of crimes. So the present consideration of Mr. Trump, is that, does that sense of proportion come through, John, in the reporting to you?
That is a great point, John, that I think people are missing in the reporting of this. And you could think of it as a return to the Framers' presidency, the Founders' presidency, and then the Woodrow Wilson presidency. So remember, Woodrow Wilson comes in, he wants to create a government of experts. And he wants his experts to be insulated from politics. We really live in Wilson's Republic right now. The government is very much organized the way Wilson wanted it to. He rejected the founders' idea of branches that were constantly fighting with each other and designed to fight with each other. So you saw that in the Adams case. Remember, the U.S. attorney resigns in New York, and she says, the only job we have is to prosecute people who we can convict based on the facts and the law. So if we think Eric Adams took a bribe and we can prove it in court, we have to prosecute him. That is my expert judgment. Donald Trump comes in through his Justice Department. He has a broader picture. And he says, every prosecution has to be in the public interest. And if there's a greater public interest to be served by dropping the charges, well, then the experts don't run something. The person who's elected by the American people in, you know, a strong victory last term, he has this agenda. Immigration was one of the top issues of that agenda, of that election. And he said, if we can get these cities to cooperate with us, then we're going to drop the prosecution. I might add, speaking of the energetic executive, and this has been missed, but I tried to raise it in my piece. George Washington did this. George Washington faced a rebellion, an insurrection in Western Pennsylvania, my home state, where my fellow Pennsylvanians didn't feel like paying the taxes on whiskey. I'm not sure they've ever paid taxes on whiskey even till today, but they had an insurrection. Washington led the army out to Western Pennsylvania, put the insurrection down. In fact, the insurrectionists fled and disbanded when they saw Washington at the head of an army coming in. And then Washington said, for the good of the country, to restore the peace, I'm ordering the U.S. attorney here to drop all the charges. Doesn't have to do with whether they're guilty. Clearly, they were guilty. But he said, there are broader considerations in mind that are at the presidential level, at the Washington, D.C. level. That's, I think, what Trump is doing here. It's not like the Saturday Night Massacre. You know, Trump isn't doing this to protect himself. He's trying to get New York City to cooperate with the federal government that's trying to execute an immigration agenda that the American people just demanded in the November elections.
I'm speaking with John Yu, a senior research fellow at the Civitas Institute, the University of Texas, an article he's posted about the ghosts of Watergate. When we come back, what is to be done? This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batch.
Stay tuned for more of CBS Eye on the World with John Batchelor.
For a limited time at Verizon, you can get our best price ever for a single line. Just $45 per month when you bring your phone, which is less than you spend on too tired to cook takeout every week. Get one line on unlimited welcome for $45 per month with AutoPay plus taxes and fees. Visit your local Columbus Verizon store by April 2nd to save. $20 monthly promo credits applied over 36 months with a new line on unlimited welcome. In times of congestion, unlimited 5G and 4G LTE may be temporarily slower than other traffic. Domestic data roaming at 2G speeds. Additional terms apply.